disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, October 2nd, 2019. In this episode, we speak with members of the Youth Liberation Front out of the Pacific Northwest. We talk about the recent climate strike, how Portland and the surrounding areas have changed from years of anarchist and anti-fascist mass mobilization, and what the YLF is doing to mobilize young people towards anti-fascist, anarchist, and anti-capitalist ideas. We then feature a discussion on the recent Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, report on domestic terrorism that liberals and centrists have been going gaga over because it mentions white supremacists several times. We pick the report apart and offer some analysis on its contents. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. In Haiti, action continues on the streets as people continue to clash with authorities and riot against austerity, the price of basic commodities, widespread corruption, and call for the ouster of the US and UN-backed president. As Unicorn Riot wrote in a recent report, at least 4 people have been killed by government forces in the past 2 weeks, with many more injured. The total number of dead and wounded has yet to be fully established. In response to the heavy-handed tactics of the police, anti-government insurgents has disarmed multiple police officers, burned police vehicles, and several police stations. The homes of government officials have also been burned. Wealthy suburbs have seen looting and demonstrations, as well as reports of gunfire. Flaming road barricades have been established throughout the capital as well, and in different areas of the country. Reportedly, following the liberation of prisoners who had been arrested in the last round of protests, the jail and central court in the southern port city of Jigmel was set ablaze. Residents of Cité Soleil, the most impoverished district of the capital of Port-au-Prince, ransacked a historically violent police station this past weekend. In repression news, the judges ruled that cases against police brutality and illegal arrest during the J20 actions can move forward in D.C. In New York, the No New Jails campaign continues, with recent actions being directed against the Ford Foundation and their support for continued jail construction. Meanwhile, 2 environmental activists who went public about sabotaging parts of the Dakota Access Pipeline have now been indicted by a grand jury and could face upwards of 100 years in prison, according to Unicorn Riot in one report, quote, "Leaked documents show that Resnick and Montoya had been targeted for surveillance by the mercenary pipeline security firm Tiger Swan. In August 2017, FBI agents raided the Catholic Worker House in Des Moines, where the 2 women had been staying, confiscating personal possessions and files. The charges announced today in the indictment come over 1 year and 2 months after the acts of sabotage were publicly claimed. In other eco news, in Olympia, Washington, protectors of the Salish Sea led a demonstration demanding that the city take action on climate change and camped out for several days before being cleared out by riot police. In San Francisco, on August 25th, people shut down a Chase Bank, an institution heavily invested in the fossil fuel industry. In Minneapolis, actions and marches continue to take place against the Line 3 pipeline, and finally, Extinction Rebellion actions also took place on August 26th. Such as in Atlanta, where people held an intersection but were attacked by police, leading to several arrests. Resistance continues to man camps and the Trans Mountain Pipeline as the Tiny House Warriors continue to blockade and fight the project. And in so-called British Columbia, Native people pushed their way into a meeting by Coastal GasLink and told them that their proposed pipeline project would not be allowed to pass through their native lands. In labor news, members of the Industrial Workers of the World, or the IWW, declared that they are forming a union inside a local pizza shop in Portland, and Burgerville workers have stated that if their demands are not met during contract negotiations, they will soon launch a strike. Also, members of the IWW in Everett, Washington, also marked the anniversary of the 1916 massacre, where 5 members of the IWW were killed in an armed clash with an anti-anarchist mob consisting of police and deputized goons hired by local bosses, Wobblies were also armed and shot back. Already on the picket lines are almost 50,000 UAW General Motors workers who have just rejected a recent contract proposal by corporate. GM has already cut workers off of health benefits and recently fired 600 workers in Mexico as the strike continues into its third week, which has already cost GM almost $1 billion. GM bosses are hoping to starve off the workers and reap the rewards of lower wages and slashed benefits through a new contract. As one report wrote, for the financial aristocracy, the defeat of the strike is a strategic and short-term question. In the face of growing signs of global economic downturn and vast technological changes, Wall Street is seeking a broader restructuring of the global auto industry and a shift of capital towards electric and automated vehicles. Though not profitable yet, these technologies promise immense returns to investors from whatever global automaker dominates the market. This will require, however, the destruction of whatever is left of the social rights of auto workers. The auto industry must impose the conditions that prevail at tech giants like Tesla, Amazon, and Google. Rather than having any expectation of long-term employment, annual raises, medical coverage, and a pension after retirement, auto workers will face the same hyper-exploitation as workers in the so-called gig economy. In anti-fascist news, people across the country responded to a flyer and sticker campaign by the neo-Nazi group Patriot Front by taking down their materials and putting up anarchist and anti-fascist ones. In Seattle, a pro-Trump rally that drew out Proud Boys was heavily outnumbered. In Colorado Springs, anti-fascists squared off against neo-Nazis and Proud Boys, who showed up to protest a drag show. Lastly, in Minneapolis, people handed out flyers following the end of a ban on anti-fascist symbols and banners at soccer matches, seeking to expand on the dialogue created by the incident. Here's the text from the flyer. We must begin by expressing our deep admiration for those who have bravely defied the MLS ban on political displays, particularly those considered Antifa. Every one of you continues to be an inspiration to us. Major League Soccer wanted a bold support culture without any of the risks that it might pose to its corporate sponsorship. The problem is that this culture is founded in a form of life that cannot simply be flattened and made marketable. We see the defiance of the ban as a beautiful defense of this way of life, a vital affirmation of what soccer culture is about, a dedication to remaining unmanageable. Some have correctly pointed out that within this culture, MLS would be nothing. That is, that by banning political displays, MLS is spurning those who have made it successful in the first place. We believe there is truth in these sentiments, that despite money and power, the supporters have leverage over MLS because of their integral role in the sport. MLS being forced to suspend the ban only proves this point. When we act together, coordinated and thoughtfully, we can exercise our own power. Together, we are unstoppable. Some ultras on occupied Dakota land. Lastly, members of the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, or RAM, dropped a banner in solidarity with the growing insurrection in West Papua. And in Oaxaca, Mexico, the newly formed National Guard has now been used to invade an indigenous community one day after it declared autonomy from the Mexican state. A clear sign of where this new police force is heading and at the direction of the Trump administration. And now for some upcoming events. From September 23rd through October 4th, the Luis Levi camp is doing a West Coast tour. On October 4th, there is a benefit for anarchist political prisoner Miguel Peralta in San Francisco. On October 6th, there is an IWW organizer training in Olympia, Washington. Also on the same day, on October 6th, there is an Anti-Fascist Day of Unity picnic happening in Austin, Texas. On October 12th, there is a Close Heartland Concentration Camp action happening in Chicago. And from October 12th through the 14th, the Tiny House Warriors are holding an Indigenous Resistance Gathering. On October 18th, the Fang Collective is doing a presentation on anti-ICE organizing in New Bedford, Massachusetts. And on October 19th through October 27th, the Mutual Aid Disaster Relief Group is doing an East Coast tour. And finally, on November 9th, mark your calendars for the Boston Anarchist Book Fair. That is going to do it for us today. As always, enjoy the interview and the discussion, and we will see you soon.
Rolling, rocking, on my wrist, I keep a knot up on me. Young scholar, stack of dollars, know I got it on me. Still tipping America, still living. Young nigga in America, tell them they can't kill him. If it ain't no jobs, niggas gotta rob. I ain't tripping, put it to your jaw for my family starve. Trill talk, shit, we gotta survive. And it's still fuck 12 to the day that I die. Fuck. You the one they love to hate on. You got a knot up in your pocket and a pistol on your waist, huh? Your little brother running plays, huh? You out here hollering about you solid and you never gon' break, huh? Your partners get a lot of cake, huh? You out here hustling on the corner for however long it take, huh? Your baby mama laid on. Car about to break down. You getting it straight out the safe now. Penitentiary time for survivor crimes. He got 20 on his head, pray hold it down. Ain't no dollars or no dreams, so we on our grind. No, they tried to stomp us out, how did we survive? Penitentiary time for survivor crimes. He got 20 on his head, pray hold it down. Ain't no dollars or no dreams, so we on our grind. No, they tried to stop us out, how did we survive? He just wanna make waves. You can't get a job rockin' afros and brains. Get paid, that's the motto. The creed like Apollo. Bleed for his paper, watch fiends play the lotto. Blinded by the struggle, ignored by the government. Daughter on the way, crack soul just to pay the rent. They barely making it, he's played with iniquity, it's destiny. Married to the game, no wedding ring. The honeymoon in Florida, the wedding gifts was kilos of vowel consignment, courtesy of Rico. Affairs with the system, he tryna stay monogamous. In the streets where he screaming, ain't nobody hard as us. But the part that's tough, see, homie in the game, waist deep but can't swim, he just talking tough. Word on the block, he talk the talk, but he can't walk enough. Compelled to pull a burner from his hip to shut the talking up. He got 20 on his head, pray hold it down. Ain't no dollars or no dreams, so we on our grind. No, they tried to stomp us out, how did we survive? Penitentiary time for survivor crimes. He got 20 on his head, pray he hold it down. Ain't no dollars or no dreams, so we on our grind. No, they tried to stop us out, how did we survive?
Okay, we're talking today with three people that are part of the Youth Liberation Front, or YLF. They are calling out of Portland. The Youth Liberation Front is comprised of different chapters across the country. But real quick, how did this group get started? What was the impetus for forming this?
So the YLF started as a... Well, it started as plans for a school walkout at a school here in Portland. And it was just a couple of organizers that kind of got together and realized, like, hey, kids out here really are taking a stand against fascism. And, like, as a group, we, like, a couple of the forming members got together and, like, reached out to a bunch of other students and held, like, a specific Youth Liberation Front walkout, which was 2017 or 18.
Yeah. So it's basically just a group of students who have decided that we're going to start working together against fascism, capitalism, environmental destruction in our area, and we started getting really big after we used social media, so that's a big part of what we do as well.
And the group is comprised of people that are in high school, or is it younger than that? Or I mean, can you be like out of high school to be part of the group? What's the kind of target membership wise?
So our soft age range right now is 14 to about 25. We have members that are older than youth, but who are still in, like, the same schools as youth and stuff like that, who are in, like, community colleges with other youth members of the YLF. who are like specifically facing a lot of the same issues that the YLF is facing.
So what made you all want to form a group that was like specifically aimed at younger folks? I mean, obviously you could join. There's a lot of different groups in the Pacific Northwest if you wanted to get involved, or there's lots of projects going on. I mean, why specifically one that's just specifically aimed at young people, and it's like by and for young folks, and that's like clearly in the, you know, the presentation of the group. Why is that important?
A lot of it is safety. Just people are more comfortable if you're underage or if you're younger. People are more comfortable being in a group with people who are closer to their age, so we don't have a lot of issues with that. In addition to safety, though, also, like, our generation is the one that's going to be facing a lot of these problems, like the rise of the alt-right in America, environmental destruction, things like that. That's what we're, like, really going to be feeling really strong effects of. And so it's just to kind of get people who are going to be dealing with these problems, give them a way to have sort of solidarity with other people who are dealing with the problems and give them tools to fix problems that they see.
Yeah, I would also add that, like, so many youth are completely, like, disconnected from anti-fascist movements already. Like, a lot of the people who, like, just last Friday went out for, like, the big climate strike had no idea who we were when we showed up in mass and stood, like, beside them and stuff. Like, so as a youth anti-fascist group, our goal is to kind of bring the same power and the same fervency for anti-fascism that older generations have into youth specifically, who have, like, the motivation to do something about it but don't know how.
Well, I wanted to ask you all about the climate strike. I mean, there's just been so much media attention focused on Greta, and also just young people in general, like specifically like Generation Z, your generation. I feel like a lot of people have focused on young folks and, you know, how they're reacting to the catastrophe of climate change. And I'm just curious, you know, what are your thoughts just on the entire climate strike? I mean, we'll get into like you know, what happened last weekend in a bit, but I'm just curious, you know, your thoughts on just the climate strike in general, just, you know, people in your generation's feelings about it. What are y'all thinking?
So the climate strike in Portland was sponsored partially by Patagonia, the company. And an issue that we really had with it was that it was very, very corporate, very capitalist. And a lot of the people who were speaking were talking about the solution to the climate crisis being to become politicians themselves. And that was just a general, like, spreading the feeling of if you're unsatisfied with being stepped on, rather than getting to the root of what's causing people to step on you, you become the person who is stepping on other people. And there's just like a general misunderstanding that people have about the way to actually address these issues. If you become a politician, if you become the person who's the actor that's creating all of these terrible things that are happening, that isn't going to solve the problem. We've been trying since the country was founded to break down the problem from the inside, and it simply doesn't work because the system that we are living under is what is creating the climate crisis. The climate crisis is a direct result of capitalism. And so when you're talking about the solution to it being becoming a politician in a capitalist state, there's really nothing in the long run that you can do that will help this crisis at all. So the thing with the climate strike is we were trying to do outreach to people who might not have that perspective in their lives, especially with the American public school system. A lot of people just don't realize that you don't have to become part of the system to solve the problem. So we, at the climate strike, we were passing out masks to help people hide their faces from potentially being doxxed and things like that, and also just as a show of solidarity, because I think a lot of marches that are run by more like liberal Democrats don't necessarily have that idea of like, this is what happens when people get together to try to solve a problem. It's more just, it's very performative. And so when we mask up, that's like solidarity between us as well as like personal protection.
Yeah, that's also very brave of y'all to go out there like that. I mean, especially with all the attention from trolls and grifters like Andy Ngo, and, you know, also just, you know, all these 30s and 40-year-old, you know, horrible people that are just out there on the far right.
I mean, yeah, if we don't do it, no one else will, so.
What was your experience at the climate march? Do you have any thoughts on just how it went? I thought it was really, really cool what y'all did, just kind of going out there and presenting an alternative. There's a report back on it's going down if you want to read it about that. I'm just curious any other thoughts you had on that day.
So it was definitely empowering seeing 20,000, 10 to 20,000 people at the climate march. I think that's the report Willana gave.
Did kids walk out of school?
Yes. Yeah, the Portland Public School let people get off like without absences for it. But
no,
like,
the climate strike could be used as an excuse.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't be like called home.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there's a tension in like, you know, one of y'all was talking about just kind of the recuperative elements using this as a way to promote, you know, green capitalism or, you know, social democracy or the future politicians of the world or whatever. Like, do you feel that is there still something to be salvaged in the school walkouts, or have they already been recuperated back into this larger thing that needs to be challenged? Like, could the walkouts in the future, like, you know, kind of like point towards a different direction in this thing?
Yeah, I think there is definitely something to be recuperated from every movement of students walking out of school, even if specifically it's not anti-capitalist in nature, it's only like one step away. So there's always, like, all these people have the motivation to do something, they're just not addressing the larger issue, they're addressing the symptoms of the issue.
And along with that, the idea that people would even think in the first place to get a big group together and walk out of school, that all these kids would think about getting a bunch of people together to do something, shows that somewhere in their minds they have the idea that if we all go, they can't stop us. It's like the Area 51 raid, which was, it did end up being a joke, but the fact that so many people had the idea that if we all went, they couldn't stop us, that means that there is something to be salvaged from that, because people recognize how powerful they are when they're together.
What do you all think will happen in terms of just the climate movement itself? Do you think that this will, like, this iteration of it will just be like a way to try to influence the Democrats in the upcoming election? Or do you think that like something like below and beyond this will like emerge out of this at a later time or near in the future? I'm just curious your thoughts.
I think that something is happening because there's more and more people showing up every single time, and it's a motivation for radicalization for those people. We talked to people at the climate march who asked about our social media and who asked about our ideology and who masked up with us. So every time people come out, that's more people joining that movement. And every time someone joins this movement, that means that there's one more person that recognizes that the system we're living under doesn't work. And that's one more person who can get in on us breaking that down.
Yeah, I think you already mentioned that we brought a bunch of masks to hand out. What we were surprised by is we brought nearly 200.
150-ish.
Yeah, which was a pretty significant amount of masks to collect and hand out. And we went to the climate march, and within like the first couple of hours had handed them all out to people and had gotten like good responses back. And by the end of the day, we were seeing a significant portion of people mashed up, standing like side by side with us. who are like ready to fight the system, and all they had was like that one push of us handing them a mask for them to join us.
And also, with the masks, what we noticed passing them out was that the majority of people who accepted them and who even acknowledged us in the first place, because there are a lot of people who just ignored us, even when we were, like, speaking directly to them, was that most of the people who took the masks were young people, like 20 and under. And the people that we got the most pushback from were older people. And when we were waiting to start the march, there were a lot of older people who were running, like, the logistical part of the protest, who had attained the permit to walk, who were asking us to move back and get out of the way and leave and to stop talking. And all of the people, or not all of them, but the majority of people who were attempting to censor us that day and who told us we couldn't speak at the open mic were older people. Mm-hmm. And then
you couldn't speak at the open mic?
They told us that they were backed up, and then also we got a lot of pushback for being masked up, and we were told that we were hijacking and all that stuff just by being there.
Yeah.
It's an interesting dynamic that everybody wants to, like, hold up the youth as this, like, shining symbol, but yet as soon as they start to organize themselves and act in a certain way or have certain ideas about what they want to do, then all of a sudden they're outsiders, they're hijacking things.
Yeah,
I was definitely thinking.
How do you feel, just being in Portland or the Pacific Northwest the last 3 years, seeing everything from these massive anti-fascist mobilizations to abolish ICE, just everything that's happened over the past couple of years, how has that changed just everyday people in Portland or the discussions you all have? I mean, there was recently a short video that went viral of some, like, far-right troll trying to, like, vandalize kids' climate strike posters and, like, saying that they were, like, radical anti-fa, and some person walking their dog on the street was just saying, like, this guy's an idiot, like, don't listen to him. It just kind of seemed to be emblematic that, like, the movements are having an effect for sure on a broad scale, at least with some people. And I'm just curious your thoughts on have you seen, like, a significant change just in the way that people relate to, talk about, or interact with more radical movements?
Yeah, those posters were some folks of ours put up in that high school, and it was definitely great to see, like, just the general population of Portland, like, not accepting these far-right instigators just antagonizing us on all fronts. In the past couple of years, it's definitely been, like, a weird change to watch as I go through high school, watching Portland, the place I've lived my whole life, just completely change up. Like, since, like, 2016, there's been, like, a solid reason for anti-fascist movements. Not that there wasn't already, but, like, Patriot Prayer, a couple other, like, fascist groups starting, like, regularly coming to Portland. And the first, like, maybe month or so where they were doing that, there was, like, almost no resistance, just because no one was expecting that. And then, like, J20 of 2016 was, like, a massive, massive anti-fascist mobilization. And, like, just moving further through, then more and more of the population has gotten much stronger feelings about how we will not tolerate fascism, we will not tolerate racism or homophobia in our own home, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that was really, like, a lot of that was shown to its full effect down at the Pop Mob event, the event marketed as the spectacle when the Proud Boys came to Portland, and, like, thousands of people showed up dressed as bananas, and, like, it's not just the Black Bloc standing here with anti-fascism. We have the MLS just recently lifted their ban on the Iron Front, which was the Timbers games, the local soccer team. All the fans were were bringing, like, Iron Front symbols to their logos or to their games and brought, like, such force behind that that they eventually got the soccer league to change the ruling back.
The ban only lasted a couple of months.
Yeah. We actually went out there a couple times and were handing out flyers for the climate strike just before because we know there's such a powerful anti-fascist movement in the,
Timbers Army.
In the Timbers Army and in just the general population of Portland. Like, people really have a strong conviction about this, which is great to see.
The thing about this is that there are a lot of youth, especially, who have the idea already. They have the idea of solidarity, anti-capitalism, anti-fascism, anti-racism already in their minds. They already agree with us, but the idea of, like, Antifa, the idea of masking up is what scares them away. So what we're trying to do is let them, and what we did with the climate strike is let them know that we don't do this to be intimidating or to be threatening. We do it to protect ourselves and to show solidarity for each other. And so the thing that's amazing about living in Portland is that there are so many people who are already willing to support us, and we just have to reach out to them.
What do you think, obviously, there's not one feeling, but what are some things that you hear from high school students when they hear about these big mobilizations, or they hear about Abolish ICE, or they hear about all this stuff about anarchists or the Black Bloc or Antifa in the news?
I think a big part of the problem is they just, like, don't hear about it. Like, of course, on the, like, the local news, Occupy ICE took up quite a bit of it, but after, like, a couple of weeks of that, it just stopped being on the news, and people just, like, high schooler just stopped hearing about it. So I think our biggest goal right now is to make people hear about it.
And also, people hear about stuff like anarchists and the Black Bloc, and they get nervous. But what we've learned, especially from the climate strike, is that it's only because they haven't been exposed to us, like, in reality yet. Once we meet people and talk to people, they understand that we're, like, in this together. And so part of the, like, a big reason that we mask up is solidarity with each other. And once they realize that, then most of them are willing to do it. And the other thing about what we hear from high schoolers is that they want to be involved, but they're not sure how to. And a big thing that we're working on is outreach with our social media and just with things like zines and meetings. We're just trying to get the idea out to people that it's okay to disagree with things that might seem like they're normal. Like, it might seem normal that people will lose their home if they don't have a stable job. That's not something that should be happening. But there are people who have never even thought of that idea before. So things that are completely ridiculous and not okay, most people, once they realize that you're able to disagree with something like that, they do. And the thing about our generation is that we're living in such a volatile time that I think most people are a lot more politically active, or at least politically aware, than they've been in the past, and are willing to act on things that they think are important.
For sure. Well, I'm just curious if you wanted to talk about any projects or anything that the YLF is working on in terms of either in your area or the broader network?
Yeah, definitely. We are mostly autonomous chapters, so, like, different chapters. Like, we have, like, a Midwest chapter that we don't specifically, like, communicate daily with because they're running their own thing. But here in the Pacific Northwest, I know we talk a lot with Seattle, and they're doing so much great work. Recently, they sold sandwiches, and at the end of the day gave all of the funds to, like, random homeless people in the street. But specifically here in Portland, we have a couple of projects coming up. Getting together a couple folks and going down and buying a bunch of coats from a Goodwill, and we're going to be passing those out to homeless people along with other basic supplies. I think we have a couple other projects.
Yeah, and the reason that we're doing projects like passing out coats, passing out tarps, is because we're not trying to be violent with our social, like, vision. We're not trying to start violence. We're trying to create solidarity and create community so that people don't need to do things like call the police or just, like, when we build community by mutual aid and things like that, then we make other things obsolete. Like, we are not looking for a fight with anyone. We are trying to make things that are harmful obsolete rather than trying to overthrow anything violently. We're trying to do, like, community outreach, because when we work together, we're infinitely more powerful than the state or than the police. If we can depend on each other, then we don't need to have those as actors in our lives.
Yeah, we also have, like, a text alert system that people can sign up for. Well, you don't even have to sign up. You just text a number. You text the number and you'll sign up for regular alerts from the YLF. And we keep people updated on if fascists are downtown protesting. We give people, like, a heads up if there's, like, some event that they have to keep an eye out for that, like, the regular news would just gloss over something or wouldn't be able to update them in time, just to keep people safe. We've done a benefit show the day after the climate march, which was how we got the funds for the coat specifically, and we'll be continuing with other shows like concerts or other shows, maybe, depending on how it goes. Just to continue building resources and community connections, because, like, there's a huge anti-fascist music scene in Portland, and there's, like, a huge population that is just ready to get together and do something, and they just don't know how. So that's our biggest goal, is just getting people together and doing something.
The other two questions I have is for younger folks that are listening to this and they're like, this is awesome, I want to get involved. What's your advice? And two, for older folks that are listening to this and they're saying, like, this is really cool, maybe I can, like, I don't know, help in some way. Like, maybe I have a sticker press or I could help print t-shirts or something like that. Like, is there something... Are there materials and help that maybe older folks that have been around for a while could help out in some way? And what are those material asks?
So with younger people, we have Discord, and we have social media. We have Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and
TikTok.
All of those are up at the end of YLF. So, young people who are listening, get on our social media, check us out, message us, talk to us. We're out here, and we're looking for people who are angry and people who want to do something about all of these, about capitalism, about the climate crisis, but don't have a way to do it, or do have a way to do it and want to help us out. We are here to let people know that they're valid and that their anger is valid and that there's something that they can do about it to turn it into productivity. Because no matter how much you post about something or talk about something, you need to do things about it to fix it. You can't just talk forever. You have to get actions together. You have to get mutual aid together. You have to do these things to kickstart the change that you want to see. Like, these climate strikes are amazing, and we are, like, in awe of people willing to come out and do this. But in addition to doing all of these strikes and coming out, people need to translate the energy that they have to get together with all their friends and do that, and get together with all their friends and do something like distribute coats or pass out zines with information about how you can be more environmentally friendly. Like, those are just a couple of things that we're working on. You need to translate your anger and your passion into action. And that's what we're here for, because these feelings that people have are valid. It's valid to be angry at the state it's valid to be angry at ICE for kidnapping people. It's valid to be angry at the police for shooting pepper balls into crowds of protesters. It's valid to be angry at police for arresting someone for allegedly drawing on a bridge. These are not things that are okay. These should not be happening, and there's a way to stop them from happening. So get on our social media and talk to us, and we can help you, and then my friend's going to talk about older people.
Yeah, we don't even have to, like, get on social media. You can meet us, like, in person all the time. We're always out here in the street. I know just tomorrow, Sunday, we're having an open public meeting, and I know we're going to have more of those soonish. And then for, like, older folks, again, the same thing applies. Like, you can always get a hold of us on social media or anything. But if you have, like, specific resources to contribute or anything, get a hold of us. We're always looking for print shops. If you have just a printer of your own and can put up, like, print out some of our posters and stick them up, that's helpful. Stickers are nice, or just people. Like, we're a youth liberation front, but we're not going to, like, turn someone away from helping us hand out coats or something. We're always looking for anyone who's interested. And there's also other anti-fascist groups that are doing exactly what we're doing here in Portland. Like, there's Rose City Antifa, who do quite a bit of good work on protecting us, like, online, on finding out who, like, fascists are. There's Pop Mob, who are a great group, who I think have really gained a lot of attention. There's Extinction Rebellion and 350 PDX, who are the folks who put on the climate march. There's so many groups you can join, and if you can't find one you like, you can always just start your own and get some friends together and go out and put up posters about your climate change, or go out and hang out with homeless folks and tell them how you, like, get their experiences. There's always something anyone can do to combat fascism and the destruction of our planet.
Anything else you all want to say, or any social media you want to kind of direct people to?
Yeah, follow us on TikTok. We'll be posting on there soon.
No,
no, but on all social media, we're PNWYLF. There's also Seattle
Seattle YLF.
Bellingham YLF. Yeah, but Midwest YLF.
But, like, yeah, there's a Midwest chapter.
They got the red.
Yeah, but
there's one in the Bay Area too, right?
Yeah, there's a bunch. We have folks up in Canada. I think there's a small European chapter, but I'm not in contact with them specifically, who are, like, killing it. But you can follow us at PNWYLF on basically anything, and we'll be there with almost daily posts telling you how you can help smash the state or smash the destruction of your world, whatever you want to do.
We're also open to ideas. If anyone out there has something that they want our help on or our support on, hit us up with the idea, and we can help you out.
Mm-hmm.
Also, fuck ICE and fuck the police.
Oh, hell yeah.
And just, if you get in contact us through internet and or through social media or anything, we are always down to meet in person. That's a lot more effective for a lot of things. So, yeah.
Okay, we are back again for another week. Shout out to everybody that went out during the climate strike and actually, you know, attempted to intervene in any way, whether it was people in Portland marching around. I know in so-called Canada, there's a couple cities that are doing stuff at the end of this week. I know a lot of people, like, handed out flyers, held banners and stuff like that. I think that's cool. I think a lot of people I've had some, you know, mixed feelings about this. In some ways, it feels like a return to the anti-war movement, where suddenly it's like we went from, you know, a lot of self-organized, different struggles, really grassroots, and then all of a sudden again to these mass kind of spectacular events where there's tens of thousands of people in the street, and then we're suddenly listening to a speaker and then going home on the bus thinking, you know, what just happened?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, you know, one thing I would say that we can do, though, is to go back to the anti-war movement when that kicked off. And I'm speaking of the one in 2003. And I know that anarchists in those situations did a couple things. One, they started doing breakaway marches from big events. So they would like pass out flyers and encourage people to basically go to the after party after the big rally. Yeah. And then they would go on marches and march towards different targets. So for instance, like I know in San Francisco one time there was one very festive and spicy march, I will say, that went to the INS building, and there was a lot of people went there and engaged. And, you know, there were other times people would go to recruiting offices or banks that were funding the war, or, you know, this was a time when a lot of people were taking action in divestment campaigns, kind of like a lot of people are doing now with ICE around different corporations that were involved in war profiteering. So there was a lot of that. So there was a lot of, playing off of these big marches in a really smart way. And then there was also people that focused on counter recruitment, stopping people from signing up to go fight the war. There was a lot of activity around doing demos and stuff, and also nighttime actions outside of, you know, recruitment stations and like, recruitment stations like Army, Marine, stuff like that. And that had a big impact for sure. And I think that was a really intelligent interventions that people could do that it, you know, tried to steer people in a really direct action oriented way.
Well, it was also about exacting economic damage. And using a sort of dynamic tactic set to do that, right? Like in a lot of cities, breakaway marches, feeder marches, things like that would pretty routinely blockade large numbers of intersections with not that many people. And the ways that that was happening largely centered around staying mobile, right? So one of the things that happened, not just in the climate strike this week, but you see this with like Extinction Rebellion actions and things like that, is it seems like often the goal is visual, right? Like get the good visual, have the big banner with big boats and stuff. And like all that's fine. But the reality is that once those things get deployed out into an area, it's become pretty run of the mill for police in most cities to learn how to route traffic around stuff like that, right? I think one of the things that was really different about anarchist tactics in the early 2000s, and this carried through to the later 2000s and even to now, was a sort of dynamic tactical approach, right? And it was something that people were kind of figuring out as they went, but that was backed up with a sort of constant flow of activity, right? So yeah, we were playing off these big actions, whether they were massive marches in DC or New York or smaller local things. A lot of us are playing off these big actions, but that was a very small tip of a very large iceberg. And there was a lot more going on behind the scenes, and like benefit shows happening constantly, and people wheat pasting posters up everywhere, and stickering campaigns, and, you know, flyering every day, all the time, like organizing on campuses, and all of that was going on all at once.
There's also a huge crossover with Iraq Veterans Against the War. There was a sizable anarchist segment of Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Yes. And I think for a lot of people in my age group, part of the reason that the war was so motivating was that it was our friends that were going to go fight that war, right? And a lot of us, I mean, especially if you grew up in an area that was even vaguely working class, like you knew of people in the military, right? You grew up with them and stuff. You knew people who got killed. You knew people who were wounded. You knew people who came back with like severe psychological trauma and like drug addiction issues and all kinds of things, right? And so we were feeling that impact very directly. I think that that's actually relatively similar to what's happening with the climate strike, but with the climate strike, it's a little bit more abstract to a lot of people, I think. With the Iraq war, your friend would come back and have a drinking problem. And that would be like a pretty direct thing. And so that kind of crossover with like anarchists and Iraq veterans against the war was really organic, right? Made a lot of sense. I think with climate actions and with the climate strike in general, even though the impact is very direct, I think it feels bigger and more abstract. It's not that climate change has PTSD attacks while they're sitting on your couch. It's this thing that we talk about still in these very abstract terms, unfortunately. And so one of the things that is similar but also profoundly different is that there is this direct connection that we have to this thing, but that I don't feel that's felt the same way. And so these actions that are happening are great, right? Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not like being overly critical. I think they're great. One of the things that I think anarchists in the anti-war movement learned early, even before the Iraq War started, I think for a lot of us, was that at some point you had to transcend symbolism and we had to actually disrupt the ability of the war to be fought. And that could come by shutting cities down and imposing economic tolls by blocking highways and stuff like that, which in a lot of cities the day and week after the war started, that's exactly what did happen. It could come from stemming the flow of soldiers to the military, right? With counter-military recruitment campaigns. It could come from, you know, blockading weapons research labs, like what happened at the National Robotics Engineering Center in Pittsburgh and a few other places. You know, there were all these things going on constantly. And I think the climate strike actions will ultimately be successful if they can build that sort of constant pace of action. And not symbolic action, but like real actual direct action. Not just sort of blocking a road with big banners like civil disobedience type stuff, but the sort of constant flow of direct action, which kind of spreads out into space and becomes kind of an almost normal activity for a lot of people. If it can achieve that, we might see some really major impact. But just like anything else, it's not going to achieve that major impact and that major resonance without that kind of constancy of activity.
Well, moreover than that, it needs to actually, like you said, transcend out of the realm of symbolic activity. Yeah. And I think what held the anti-war movement back was that it was based on the idea that we're trying to like put pressure on the president to stop the war. And then, the sad thing was that once the war started, I mean, it was like the air was let out of the bag. I mean, people were like, well, the war started. It's over. Time to go home. And, you know, if anything, that was the time to increase the pressure and, you know, look for tangible ways to engage in solidarity, not only with people over there, but, you know, continue with the anti-war work happening here in the United States. And I mean, I fear the same thing's going to happen where people are going to be like, well, if we can just get them to pass the Green New Deal, or if we can just make the Democrats, you know, take a position like this against climate change, or if we can just get Joe Biden to, you know, wear a green suit or whatever, you know, and get his sons to not engage in the fracking industry or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Whatever it is that week, you know, and I fear that that's really kind of like what, not only will people kind of be pushed into a de facto default stance, but also the people kind of leading these things, quote unquote, will really push people to do. And I don't know. It's interesting too, because the climate strikes are also, it's like a lot of things nowadays. Well, there will be like a tinge of self-organization, you know, there will be like, you know, student walkouts and stuff where it's like, you know, people like us, of course we're going to support student walkouts, you know, totally support the kids walking out, and that's great. And I think that's going to be a really transformative experience. And also there's this rhetoric behind the climate strikes that's like, well, if you don't listen to us, you know, we're going to revolt, or, you know, change is coming whether you like it or not. You know, there's this kind of like tinge in the back of it of like a popular insurrection or something like that. But at the same time, I know that a lot of the people engaging in stuff, of course, do not want that whatsoever. Like, they literally want policy changes to the Democratic Party. And well, I think until people can really transition to something symbolic, to something more direct, you know, we'll just continue to see more of the same.
Well, and that's probably what held back the climate strikes to some degree, right? Not just tactically, but in sheer attendance and interest. Is the reality is that a lot of the rhetoric that was coming out of a lot of the local groups, including the local group where I'm at, and in a lot of other cities, was very much like, hey, let's put pressure on politicians, and it's election season, right? And if we learned anything from the anti-war movement, it's that when people allow their politics to get subsumed by the Democratic Party, that ultimately leads to inaction, right? A lot of the steam came out of the anti-war movement because people went to go campaign for John Kerry, which worked out super well, obviously. Even though John Kerry himself was not a person who was interested in ending the Iraq War and was like pretty overt about that, He wasn't George W. Bush, right? And so we're seeing a lot of the same kind of dynamics playing out right now, with this kind of Democratic Party lurch into the progressive left, right? Like, we've been watching, I mean, Elizabeth Warren is polling higher than Joe Biden in Iowa right now, which is astonishing in a lot of ways. But if you really look at what a lot of her campaign is based on, it's based on taking positions from the kind of progressive Democrat / Democratic socialist sort of left and sort of moderating them to a degree where they can be acceptable to whatever is considered to be the quote moderate voter. And then putting them out on stage in relatively eloquent language, right? Like, that seems to be kind of the strategy there. And a lot of people are buying that. And just like in 2004, there's a lot of people sitting around going, well, you know, like, if we just, like, get Trump out of office and vote and get the Green New Deal in place, like, we'll save the planet or whatever. And not only is that fallacious to an absurd degree, right? Climate change is already a thing that's happening and having really severe consequences. It's not a thing that can be stopped in the way that people hoped to have stopped it in the 90s. It's kind of a reality that we have to come to terms with. But just essentially pumping money into the renewable energy industry isn't going to fix that either, right? I think that this is really pretty typically American in the 21st century, this kind of tendency to want to have things change drastically without wanting to give up the comforts of American life. And a lot of the rhetoric around the Green New Deal now, or sort of policy proposals that are sort of concurrent to that, is very much along the lines of, well, you know, you can still have all your, like, typically American consumerist things. We'll just do it in a more ecologically sustainable way. I mean, it's the inconvenient truth, like Al Gore politics embodied in a policy. And what's happening is that a lot of the people that have sort of dominated the discussion around climate change so far tend to be sort of progressive Democrat liberals who are trying to sort of bring that back into the Democratic Party to force the Democratic Party to take positions. And that's not a place where direct action or street action is ever going to be organized from. There's already an outlet for that. You can go vote in the primaries, right? But for those of us that know that that's not going to fix the problem, we have to start really thinking, we have to start thinking about forms of intervention within that sort of an initiative, which is already happening, or start to think about branching off on our own. Because the reality is that just like in the anti-war movement, the liberals are going to leave the streets. I mean, they came out this last week, but they're going to leave the streets the second that voting becomes a thing. And we have to just be ready for that. That's the reality.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention before we kind of end on this part, there was some ridiculous Vice article that was talking about the shutdown in D.C. that happened the other day, which is, you know, fine, good on them. But it said, like, finally, the climate movement is no longer civil or something like that. Or, you know, it was, like, lauding them that they, like, shut down an intersection for an hour. It's like, motherfuckers, it's like people have been like fighting pipelines for like how long? Like, you know, I don't know. It's just funny now. It's like, you know, it wasn't the climate movement when Jeff Lewis was, you know, burning SUVs or people were fighting pipelines or something like that. It's only a climate movement now that it's, you know, a bunch of nonprofits in the street or something like that.
Well, I was just going to say that. I mean, for people that are listening to this that are really involved in the climate strikes, like, A, awesome, like, keep doing your thing, right? But B, if you're new to this, like, really look back at the history of militant ecological resistance, right? And we're not just talking about, like, you know, actions from the late 90s that involved, you know, relatively destructive direct action, but also things like Earth First, also things like pipeline blockades, right? Like, these things have been going on for a very long time in the United States. And I mean, there's a 40-year history of this stuff. And a lot of the people that are around the scenes that you're in were probably involved on some level or another with, you know, organizing a tree sit or helping to shut down mountaintop removal mining or something like that, right? I mean, some of these campaigns that happened in the mid-2000s, which involved long-term blockades of entire mountains in West Virginia for months and months and months and months, often involving very small groups of people, None of that gets talked about anymore. But those are the things that really did have impact, right? I mean, the threat of direct action and minor forms of direct action were a major part of shutting down hydrofracking in upstate New York, right? For example, and turning that into a permanent ban. And so, like, direct action has won very concrete victories in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years in the United States, and has actually, you know, prevented relatively severe ecological destruction in relatively local areas. And so it's a thing that I really encourage those of you that showed up and were like really excited about blocking roads and stuff, to really look into. I mean, there's plenty of really good histories about that that have been written, over the last 10 years or so. There's a lot of people that were involved in those things that are still around, that would be more than happy to talk to you. There's still, like, I mean, Earth First is still going relatively strong, right? And they have a journal and all that stuff. And really, really start to dig into those kinds of things, because, I mean, there's a lot to be learned from those experiences, especially because there's such a depth of experience, in those communities.
Yeah, I mean, we have to fundamentally ask ourselves, where are the tens of thousands of people that are coming out to these, and why aren't they on the front lines of all these different ecological struggles being waged? I mean, you know, it's great that all these people came out, but if even a fraction of them would have been involved in the BioBridge pipeline fight, I mean, we could have shut that thing down.
Yep.
You know, I mean, where are these people at that came out in the tens of thousands for the Yellowfinch tree sit blocking the Mountain Valley pipeline?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's where we need people.
Yeah.
Like, if we had tens of thousands of people out on the front lines, I mean, we could really start doing some stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, we've got to start thinking along those lines. But let's continue on to the next topic. I want to bring up, there was an article that came out in Vice again, to go back to them. It's about a new DHS, Department of Homeland Security report about terrorism, counterterrorism. The Vice headline was something along the lines of, here, I'll just pull it up right now. DHS just finally recognized white nationalism as a major terror threat. Now, I've seen a lot of people share this around on social media, you know, a lot of people that are more in the, you know, quote unquote, extremist world that monitor extremism. People that are more or less sympathetic to anti-fascists, but, you know, kind of toe this really neoliberal line. And first of all, look, this isn't, the U.S. government has not finally recognized white nationalism as a major threat. I mean, Oklahoma City happened. There's been different waves in which, you know, the U.S. government has repressed and actively gone after, you know, quote unquote, the white nationalist movement, the far right. Certainly it hasn't viewed it as much of a threat in which the public has in the last couple of years. But also the DHS has definitely written about the far right. I mean, a lot of people mention this kind of obscure, small, like, pamphlet report that the New Jersey Department of Homeland Security put out about anti-fascism. I don't know why it's just in New Jersey. But, you know, a lot of people have referenced this report. I mean, it's a joke, really, in a lot of ways, because the only violence that alludes to is the Sacramento protest, in which, you know, large majority of anti-fascists were stabbed, and the language caused with written within it makes it seem as if the anti-fascists are the ones doing the stabbings. But at the same time they put that report out, they also did one on, you know, the alt-right. They did one on Identity Europa. They did one on the National Socialist Movement. In fact, I remember looking on Twitter and seeing the DHS tweet that report out, and the National Socialist Movement was the first one that commented on saying, yay, finally! It's like, you idiots, they just did one on you. You know, it's like, so.
Well, and, I mean, Mike German, right, like, who, anyone that's been reading articles about this or anything having to do with the FBI and, like, anti-fascism over the last year has probably heard his name. He's a legal scholar, I think, at NYU. But he used to be an FBI investigator. And part of his role was infiltrating white nationalist groups in the 90s, right? So, like, it's not that it's not a recognized thing. I think that there's a lot of fear about the FBI not caring, because, you know, probably on a local level they don't. But the reality is that it's not a revelation that white nationalists are on their radar. I think what what was amazing to me, and I, you know, sacrificed a lot of my weekend to read this entire DHS document, which is like 40-something pages long, which was referenced by this Vice article. And they mention white nationalism a few times, more or less in passing. There's nothing new in that report. I mean, like, the thing that was amazing to me, and we were talking about this before we started recording, the thing that was amazing to me is that people made such a big deal out of this. I mean, seriously, like, if people are interested in reading government documents, like, go read this report. Because of the sort of stunning level of banality that you'll find. I mean, essentially, they talk a lot about Islamic terrorism. They talk a lot about how priorities need to shift since 9/11 and how they haven't really done that yet. And how they really need to shift focus to domestic, homegrown radicalism, as they put it. And go through all these means that they're going to do that, most of which are things they're already doing, right? Like partnering with private organizations, right? They already consistently solicit private industry for intelligence information. They already work with private intelligence companies all the time. They're already doing industry-specific briefings pretty consistently. They have entire information sharing centers for certain industries like utilities and finance and things like that. All of that's already happening, right? They talked about sharing information with JTTF and fusion centers, already doing that. Start talking about using, you know, community policing in order to gather information. Anyone that lives in a city that's had a major event, like national security special event in the last like 4 or 5 years, has already seen this. Nothing in that report actually really stands out except the fact that they're entirely obsessed with drones. And that comes up a whole bunch. But the idea that this report marks a fundamental shift in the FBI's approach to investigating white nationalism, just isn't true. It's a nice headline. No. I think it's a nice thought for a lot of people, that are really trying to hope that the FBI will solve the deep-seated cultural and societal roots of white nationalism in the United States, which it won't. But for those that hold that, you know, naive hope out there, headlines like that are really hopeful. But the reality is that not only will the FBI not solve white nationalism, but that report doesn't even say that it will. There's nothing in there that we haven't seen before.
No, and there's nothing in here that says, like, look, gang, it's like the Nazis or the alt-right or the white nationalists are the problem. It doesn't say that. It basically right. says, like, look, there's a hodgepodge of different groups out there. I'm going to read some of the sections to you in a second. But there's, you know, a collection of bad actors out there. And basically this is a text on how they're going to secure their shit, how they're going to protect yeah. their infrastructure yeah. and make sure that no one comes into their house and plays with their toys or disrupts, you know, the day-to-day operations of, you know, a techno-industrial civilization. There's nothing in here that says, like, you know, dang, yo, the white nationalists are killing people, like, we've got to double down on this. It doesn't say that at all. I mean, it mentions, like, as you said, it mentions white nationalists several times when it talks mm-hmm. about it. But let me just read you, you know, one couple sections. This is a part of their opening thing. It says, the evolving nature of the threat. This is the second paragraph. One change is that more diverse sets of actors and motivations now pose significant security concerns than any time since 9/11. Domestic terrorists are motivated by racial or ethnically motivated violent extremism, anti-government and anti-authority violent extremism, and other violent extremist ideologies represent a growing share of the threat to the homeland. They capitalize homeland. It's interesting, too, because they also go on to mention that, like, some of the biggest, quote, terrorist events that have happened are motivated by people that have no ideological underpinnings. So, for instance, yeah. they mention, like, the Las Vegas shooting, which, you know, 60 or so people died, and I think over, like, 400 or some crazy number, like, were injured, mm-hmm. Which I think factors into what they're talking about, because they're basically saying, like, look, society is unraveling. I mean, they don't say that, but, you know, shit's getting worse. People are killing people because society's coming apart. We need to protect what's ours. But if you read into what they're saying, when they mention motivated by racial or ethnically motivated violent extremism, there's nothing in there that delineates that from white nationalists to quote unquote black identity extremists. They could be talking about either one, and of course they are. And of course, in reality, they're probably talking more about the threat of quote black identity extremists or black people asserting their right to exist in a racist society. And also this term anti-authority violent extremism. I mean, who are they talking about? They're talking
They specifically lay it out, right?
Yeah.
So they're talking about anarchists, but right. They do this interesting thing, which some people have called the FBI out for, and DHS out for, which I think is important. Just like they try to bundle quote unquote black identity extremism, in with white nationalism as, you know, racially motivated violence. They also try and bundle anarchists and sovereign citizen groups together as anti-government extremists, right? And they specifically mention that in this report.
Yeah.
That is a shift. So if you looked at FBI reports from 10 years ago, they very specifically would talk about anarchists as their own special category, separate from sovereign citizen groups. And the reason that they were doing that is that, and I don't know how much this indicates a shift of actual thinking inside of federal intelligence agencies, but generally, there was an understanding, which is accurate, that sovereign citizen groups and nationalist militias and white nationalist groups all sort of circulated around together, right? And you would often see, like, sovereign citizens end up at places like Elohim City, which is a white nationalist, I guess, commune, I guess you would call it.
Intentional community.
Intentional community. Yeah, that's a way to put it. and a number of others, right? And you would see like far right wing Christian millenarian groups mingling with, you know, militia organizations, right? And that was all a relatively normal thing. There's a really good documentary on Netflix about Oklahoma City, which I know we've mentioned the one about Ruby Ridge a lot, and they get into this a little bit. But the one about Oklahoma City is really fascinating. For people that are listening to this that don't know a lot about the history of the far right in the 90s, which really explains a lot about the far right now, I really highly recommend watching that, because one of the things it does is it tracks Timothy McVeigh, and it runs through how he would end up, you know, outside Waco and then be distributing pamphlets about conspiracy theories at gun shows. And from there, he would pick up a copy of the Turner Diaries, and then he would run into some sovereign citizen types, and how all of those sort of what in some way are ideologically separate and what in some way are not ideologically separate sort of tendencies within the far right sort of commingled. The way that the FBI approached those kinds of things was they approached that as a sort of circulation of people, separate from what was going on with anarchist groups, right? This sort of shift into conflating categories, in a DHS report, the one concern about that, and this has been articulated by a number of people who, do sort of national security analysis on a sort of more mainstream media kind of level. One of the things that is very concerning about that is their ability to group those categories together and be able to use the same repressive mechanisms and to be able to get funding for those repressive mechanisms by doing so. So if they say, hey, we need this money to go after racially motivated extremism, they will get their money. But they might not necessarily use that to go after white nationalists. They might also use that to go after Black Lives Matter groups, for example, right? Who they classify certain wings of as, quote, black identity extremists, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's really the concern, is that they're able to sort of leverage, and this is more a concern about political operatives within these agencies, that they can leverage actual right-wing violence as a way to gain resources to repress, you know, sort of anti-racist and anti-fascist and anarchist political tendencies.
Right.
That's a concern. And that was something that was sort of pretty endemic in the report. Whenever they talked about anything that wasn't Islamic extremism, right?
Yeah. 'Cause
they, this conflation. But that's something they've been doing for years already at this point.
Yeah. And I'm actually going to read the passage right there. And so before that, they do break down. They said, look, there's a couple paragraphs on, they refer to them as white supremacists, acts of terror,
You know, they talk about all the major shootings, El Paso, Pittsburgh, so on and so forth. They mention Gab, 8chan, Int-chan. I've never heard of that chan. Encrypted channels. They say celebration of violence and conspiracy theories about the ethnic replacement of whites and the majority ethnicity in very Western countries are prominent in their online circles, blah, blah, blah. But then right after that, they say another significant motivating force behind domestic terrorism has been anti-government / anti-authority violent extremism. This ideology has been associated with multiple plots and attacks, but they only mention one, and hostile nation states often, this is interesting too, this line, and hostile nation states often promote it in their disinformation efforts. In July 2019, an anarchist claiming affiliation with the, quote, Antifa movement attempted to firebomb a U.S. ICE facility in Tacoma, Washington, and threatened responding law enforcement officers with a firearm. On multiple other occasions, self-proclaimed sovereign citizens, this again, this is what you're talking about, the equating the two, sovereign citizens claiming their independence from federal law enforcement have targeted law enforcement officers and other officials. And I mean, I can think of like one recent example. A couple years ago, a couple sovereign citizens literally, I think, slaughtered a couple police officers in a restaurant, I believe, and then left literally a Nazi flag on the table and left. Yeah.
I mean,
there's multiple cases, and of course, as we've said, I mean, the far right has murdered far more law enforcement officers than, you know, quote unquote, the left or, you know, black identity extremists, which do not exist, have, you know, in the past, you know, 20 or 30 years or whatever. Okay. But anyway, a couple interesting things. First, this thing about being promoted by foreign governments. I don't know. That seems to be like a weird playoff of the Russia thing. And then there's also this thing where they conflate anti-authority violent extremists with sovereign citizens. And again, there's of course the conflation of, you know, property with actually dead human beings.
So what we have to remember about anything that comes out as an official DHS document, just like anything that comes out as an official FBI document, not something from field office, but like an actual report with a cover that gets released from, you know, the national office. Those things go through political appointees, right? So this DHS report gets vetted by Trump administration appointees, right? Just like any official FBI national office release goes through the Justice Department. What that means is that language gets inserted and changed or is written in a very specific way, right? And so when we're talking about this tendency to conflate categories, right, the one thing that's important about that is the political motivation behind that, right? We really need to think through what they're actually really trying to get at there. One of the things that they talk a lot about is, as you mentioned earlier, sort of non-ideologically motivated mass attacks, right? I forget the term that they exactly use.
They say targeted violence. This is interesting. They say many perpetrators of mass attacks do not appear to fit the definition of terrorists because they lack a clear ideological motive. They may often be responding to perceived grievance, whether domestic, workplace, or other nature. Mass attacks are a persistent problem and a grave concern. According to the U.S. Secret Service, 27 mass attacks have been carried out in public space in the United States in 2018, which is incredible, killing 91 people. In 2017, 28 mass attacks claimed 147 lives. In the past 3 years, the nation witnessed the two deadliest mass attacks in modern American history, including the 2017 shooting at an outdoor concert in Las Vegas that killed 58 people and injured 869. Wow, that's disgustingly incredible. That is sick.
Yeah.
God, well, that is... Oh.
And part of what's potentially concerning about that is sort of two things, right? The first is that they're bundling that together with terrorism, right? So they're saying, look, we're going to use the same methods that we use against terrorists to, you know, try and investigate kids at a high school who talk about shooting up their school.
Well,
So there's that concern. And any of us that were in high school and maybe a little like alty around Columbine know what that experience was like, right? It wasn't fun.
Oh, the kid with the Nine Inch Nails shirt.
The counselor's office every other day because you decide to wear black to school, right? Like that kind of stuff. Right. So there's a significant concern there. But I think that one of the other concerns I have is if we look at Trump administration rhetoric around the El Paso shooting, one of the things that they consistently harp on is this idea of, really, we can't think about this through the lens of politics. We have to think about this through the lens of mental illness. And so by constructing this category that they then try and shim into the same report as terrorism, what potentially they might be doing is creating an out for themselves, right? To be able to say, look, we're not creating this problem. White nationalism isn't creating this problem. Or as Candace Owens said in front of Congress again this week, white nationalism isn't a real thing. Really, it's mental illness. Mental illness is the problem.
Yeah, they actually break down when they're talking about threat assessments. They say most of the attackers utilize firearms. Half are motivated by a grievance related to a domestic situation, workplace, or other personal issue. Two-thirds had histories of mental health symptoms, including depressive, suicidal, or psychotic symptoms.
Yeah, and that might be true, right? However, even if that is the case, even if the El Paso shooter had a history of mental illness, right? Even if someone like James Reardon, who got arrested in Ohio before he shot up a synagogue, had a history of mental illness, right? Even if that's true, that doesn't explain their target choice. Right. And that doesn't explain their motivation. What it might explain is potentially the route that led them there. But it doesn't necessarily, at least in part, but it doesn't necessarily explain why you would choose to shoot up a synagogue or why you would choose to shoot up a Walmart in El Paso. Right. That those are things that you can't explain away without falling back into talking about white nationalism. It's impossible. The thing that's concerning about that specific line, and it's impossible to know the intent of the writer in this case, but if we take that and we think about it in the light of it being a DHS report, and we think about it in the light of current Trump administration rhetoric around mass shootings, one of the things that they've done is they've tried to leverage mental illness as a way to absolve themselves of responsibility and to absolve white nationalists of responsibility and to start to really craft this narrative that nationalism is fine, right? It's really the problem is people who identify as nationalists but also have mental illness issues, right? And that seems to be the line that they've been pushing for the last month. Mm-hmm. And then it shows up in this report as well, potentially, or at least conclusions that start to form edges around that position coming from the administration are very much articulated in the report. And so there's a number of concerning things that come up in the report. But again, I want to emphasize this reality, which is none of that is new, right? So like, reporters' advice, like, good on you for bringing this to people's attention and stuff, right? But it's not like anything in this report is groundbreaking or anything in this report is a revelation or anything in this report even indicates any difference in approach. What's actually most interesting in this report to me is how much this articulates already given positions in a very clear way and how it's starting to lay out the idea that there's officialdom behind those positions, right? That there's this official document that seems like it's written in relatively articulate, pretty dry, pretty banal language, like government report language, that seems to form the foundation for things that are being said by the administration. And that is very concerning. But that's not the thing that people are focusing on when they're talking about this report at all.
No, I mean, and again, there's nothing in here that says, like, you know, President Trump says one thing and then there's an uptick in, you know, violent attacks or, you know, mosques have seen, you know, explosion of threats and like bomb attacks and threats, you know, synagogues have seen an explosion of, you know, violent attacks and bomb threats and so on and so forth. And like anti-Semitic vandalism, you know, we've seen an uptick in anti-LGBTQ, you know, violence, so on and so forth. There's nothing like that. And it just says, look, there's anarchists, there's militias, there's white nationalists, there's Islamic fundamentalists. I mean, they are basically one boat of potential terrorists, and then you've got the rest of society who's just fucking crazy, and they're going around killing everybody, so therefore we need to really beef up everything we're doing. That means more contracts with private firms. That means more surveillance. They talk about beefing up JTTF, which is Joint Terrorism Task Force, essentially political police, beefing up fusion centers, giving more resources to local cops, more information sharing, more hardware, more software. And like you were saying, I mean, if you look at this from a standpoint of like, you know, we want to grow our enterprise, we want to grow the amount of infrastructure and stuff that we have to surveil the population. I mean, I would look at this and then say, like, this is exactly why, you know, 2/3 of what we're dealing with are people, you know, going into an open air concert and murdering a bunch of people. This is exactly why we need facial recognition technology. This is exactly why we need door cameras. This is why we need, you know, massive state surveillance, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, predictive pre-crime technology.
And they're trying to build that case, right? I think the thing that they can't address and that no government report could ever address is what the root causes of this are, right? So, I mean, we can all point to the root causes of the uptake in white nationalism, and it's not Donald Trump, right? He might be a motivating factor in an immediate sense. But the reality is that, again, white nationalism is deeply, deeply entrenched in the mentality of the entire American project. I mean, as a colonial state. And this idea of white entitlement and sort of white rage over that entitlement being in any way threatened is really what's sort of bringing this back up in the forms that it's sort of emerging, right? I mean, we saw the same thing with Gamergate, right? Where, you know, dudes who were used to having extreme levels of male privilege started reacting very violently to just the insinuation that maybe that was a form of social repression, right? And they started doxing people and sending death threats to people and threatening to blow people's houses up and stuff over just the simple insinuation that maybe male-identified, male-bodied people shouldn't have absolute total power over absolutely everything. We see the same thing with, you know, right-wing Christian groups who constantly complain about religious repression because they can't force everyone to pray to their God in school, right? These sorts of mentalities of entitlement are very, very, very deeply rooted in the entire American project, right? We can think back a ways to concepts like manifest destiny. We can also think back to the sort of genocide of indigenous people as westward expansion happened. But we can think of even more modern examples like the war in Iraq, right? Which was entirely built on this idea of American exceptionalism and American entitlement, right? That these sort of concepts of entitlement are so deeply ingrained in the way that we think politics and in the way that the American project is structured, that they're literally enshrined in our founding documents, right? That if we really think back to the actual philosophical implications of what's being said in those documents, it's not just that they're describing this sort of concept of what they're calling liberty and freedom of expression and so on. It's that they're saying that they've understood the universal truth of human existence, and this is what that is. And that they are the absolute rational people that are capable of understanding that. And the arrogance of those statements is absolutely astonishing, right? And that cuts back to the very base ideas that we form the entirety of American politics around. So, of course, a federal government document cannot sit there and say, well, the problem is the entire American project. We should just end it all now and that'll solve the problem. They obviously can't say that. But what they end up defaulting back to is that the solution to them is to not just perpetuate, but grow the capacity of the same project that's creating the foundations for the problem. The level of social alienation that people feel, the grounding of the American project to white nationalism, like these are things that are fundamentally endemic to the very structure of the American social space. And so what the DHS is doing here is essentially trying to make the argument that What we really need to do is we really need to build the capacity to deal with the crisis that our actions and our understanding of social space and political structure generate. But that, again, is not a new thing. I mean, we can go back to the very formation of the DHS in 2001, and you will see very similar arguments happening, right? I mean, we can talk about the expansion of NSA surveillance programs, and you'll see the very same arguments happening, right? So, I mean, again, these things aren't new. I think the thing that is really astonishing to me about this report, and I've already said this, is how riled up people got about it. Because you could probably handpick a dozen documents that come out of, you know, federal law enforcement or intelligence agencies or even just bureaucracies, and you would see more or less the same language, articulated almost entirely across the board at this point.
Yeah, and again, this is another example of, you know, quote, the media or people within the media, you know, large corporations patting the back of law enforcement, being like, oh, what, thank you finally for listening to the voice of the people. But yet these same institutions are, you know, the ones hounding and attacking social movements.
Yeah.
You know, for every little thing. I mean, literally today, yeah. Newsweek ran an article by Andy Ngo, and Andy Ngo today argued, saying that the violence of Antifa at the climate march in Portland, where children who were participating in the Youth Liberation Front were shot with automatic pepper balls, you know, nearly point blank range outside of an ICE facility while they chanted and held signs, you know, was out of control, and their violence was a reason why they should not be allowed into any social movements, essentially, you know, because of course Andy Ngo is just the person that you just go to about that type of stuff. You know, this is after he's been essentially, this is after he's been kicked out of his own grifter far-right publication, and he's been disgraced in the eyes of, you know, most people. And here is, again, Newsweek just opening their arms to him because he's the only one that's willing to, like, fly that flag. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And,
yeah.
Yeah,
there's,
I think
people... There was a really good piece in The Atlantic that came out yesterday about this sort of tendency of journalists to engage in, and editors, to engage in both sidesism to a completely absurd degree, right? To create kind of false equivalencies, partially because they don't actually know what they're talking about, right? Partially because, you know, they're trying to maximize market space. But what the article is essentially arguing is that, you know, we can look, I mean, it was using the 2016 election as an example, but it says we can look at the way that politics is covered in the United States, and we can see how journalistic outlets, in this case Newsweek, are trying as hard as they can to maintain two things simultaneously. One is readership, right? So they have to write spectacular stories with spectacular headlines and maximize the amount of people that will read them, and so on, because media is a sort of unfortunately dying industry. But also to engage in this sort of idea that really there's always more than one point of view that's legitimate to be represented in any one discussion. And so we end up with an organization like Newsweek, which by and large for mainstream press doesn't suck as bad as some. Like I'll definitely give them that, running an article by a person who, you know, it would be very generous to call a journalist, right? And I would argue is very much not a journalist. It would be the same as if Newsweek ran an article by me and didn't label it an op-ed, right? I wouldn't expect them to do that. I'm not an impartial participant in things, right? Nor would I ever pretend to be, but neither is Andy Ngo, neither is the DHS, right? That we really need to start, and this is the argument that is being made in The Atlantic, is that we really need to start to understand that the equivalencies that are being posed are not actually equivalencies, that they're more born out of a bunch of journalists with timeline crunch and no actual background understanding trying to write comprehensive articles about a thing based on a fraudulent notion of journalistic objectivity, right? And when we see an article like what came out in Vice, like, yeah, I mean, they mention white nationalism. But that's also not the only time they've ever done that. And so when I read the original article, the thing that I took away from that is that the writers were trying to achieve two things. One was write a spectacular article that lots of people are going to read because, you know, it's Vice. And for as much good work as Vice does do, which, you know, again, as far as like largely read online media, Vice doesn't suck comparatively, right? They do some really good stuff, and they've done a lot of really good stuff over the years. And I have a lot of respect for a lot of the writers at Vice. I think they do a really good job. But Vice also has a history of, you know, spectacularized headlines and stories in order to gain readership. They have a very long history of that. And this very much, I think, falls into that category pretty directly, right? Pretty firmly. Federal intelligence agencies are Byzantine structures, right? I mean, they're incredibly complex. There's a lot of internal politics. If you're not a person like, say, myself, and I'm in no way an expert, but I definitely read a lot about this, who sort of obsessively reads about these things, and has for years and years and has like a lot of background on that, it can be pretty easy to cherry pick information coming out of federal reports, right? If you read them in their totality, and if you take that in, you know, and you start to, you know, mesh that understanding with an understanding of the internal politics of agencies and the politics of political appointees and certain administrations and blah, 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 the picture becomes a lot more complicated. Right. And you can see this, you know, if anyone wants really fascinating reading on this level, the WikiLeaks release of the State Department cables from a few years ago, is fascinating. And one of the things you'll see is you'll see a lot of internal debate, about policy positions that would fly back and forth over those email lists. And then if you were to then go and read the official State Department releases, that were coming out around the same time about those very same questions, you would see a very different picture. And I think that that's something that we all need to keep in mind whenever a document like this gets released, is that what we're seeing here is we're essentially looking at the most generic distillation of internal discussions that's then filtered through the lens of political appointees, right? That's what a report like this represents. It's very different than a raw FBI field office sort of information release, which often is written by like one or two people, might have been approved by another one or two people, and then is released out into the world. That's much more direct. What we're watching here is we're watching the end result of a process which probably took, you know, at least 2 months, if not more, to write and edit and change and fit within a political narrative that was already constructed by political appointees, which was being handed down by the administration. And that's not unique to the Trump administration. I mean, that is something which happens in every American administration. And you can go back and read the same kind of reports from the Reagan administration, and you'll see a very similar dynamic, right? Like if you follow the rhetoric in the report and you start to fuse that with an understanding of the people involved and their politics and their sort of motivations inside Washington, their political factionalization, and then you start to fuse that with their understanding of gaining power within the Reagan administration, a lot of those documents start to make sense in a very different way. And this is no exception to that, right? I think we have to, whenever a document like this comes out, don't get caught up in the hype about it and actually really step back and start to think of this as one more data point in a trend analysis of what we're seeing in general. Not just as a, hey, look, they mentioned this thing in a report. I think that that's the wrong way to sort of read documents like this.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.